Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today, I'm interviewing a very interesting person. She happens to be my daughter, Dr. Penelope Caldicott. She's Australian and spent much of her life, specifically adolescent years, in Boston, where she was educated. She came home and did medicine at the University of Newcastle. She now runs an integrative medical centre, and she will explain to you what that means. Welcome to the program, Penny.
Thank you.
First, I'd like to ask you, I know I am your mother, but when did you first become interested in medicine, Penny?
I think that I've always been interested in medicine, maybe not at a kind of intellectual level, but I felt quite drawn towards medicine. When I was in my early teens, I started to become aware of my interest in medicine, and that stayed with me more like a gut feeling, I think, for a number of years until I applied to do medicine when I was 19.
Did your family background have anything to do with your interest in medicine?
My family background was probably the one thing that prevented me from wanting to do it.
How?
I think it's hard. Well, for me, it was I really wanted to do my own thing. I was not really interested in following in the footsteps of my parents. But in fact, the kind of medicine that I was interested in doing was very different than the medicine that my parents did.
Well, I remember having a discussion with you when you were 16 and actually not violently disagreeing with you, but definitely disagreeing because you were thinking about alternative medicine therapies, and I'm a very Western-trained conservative physician. Do you remember that discussion, and where were your ideas originating and coming from?
Okay, I think that discussion was probably just a little bit later than that. I think we were driving in the car with you and Dad. And I can't actually say where my ideas were originating. It was more of a feeling that I wanted to practice a type of medicine that was really able to address the cause of disease states rather than just the disease states themselves. And I just was intrinsically interested in other types of therapies. And I guess I've become, over the years, really interested in what we call these therapies, because we call many things alternative when we think they don't fit into the Western paradigm, which I think in to a large degree is quite an unscientific label for them.
And when you were growing up, were you interested in helping people and looking after them per se, as doctors do, or did it come from a more of an intellectual perspective, or was just innate?
It's always hard to describe this, and it depends on your point of reference. But for me, medicine's felt like a vocation or kind of a mission. And it was really a feeling that I had in the pit of my stomach more than in my head.
Yes.
So that's always been the case for me. And I think if I'd approached it from an intellectual perspective, I would have been much more concerned about my grades, how well I was doing, whether I'd make the mark. And that never really came into it for me. I was really lucky that my path led me into doing medicine without having to consider that too much.
Yes, I guess if you'd been at Harvard Medical School, it would have been a different story, whereas you went to a relatively new medical school at Newcastle University, just north of Sydney. Would you like to describe that new curriculum and how it differed from, say, the University of Sydney or Harvard or Yale or a traditional medical school?
Sure. And in fact, we can talk about Harvard or Yale, but Sydney University has also been a very conservative medical school, as have many of the universities in Australia, certainly at the time when I started medicine, which was in 1983 or 84.
Yeah.
So Newcastle was set up to be similar to a university that's also in Canada, and it's set up around a curriculum that's based on what they call problem-based learning. So that rather than studying each discipline separately, you study in an integrated manner. So you may be introduced to a certain problem which you have to investigate, diagnose, treat, and look at all the systems involved in that problem. So you learn your anatomy, your physiology, your pathology, your pharmacology based around the problems that you're studying.
And isn't that relative to a particular patient? Didn't you start seeing patients in first year medicine?
The cases weren't necessarily, they may be based on real cases. They weren't real patients that we were looking at to do the problem based learning, but certainly around that you would be starting from the first year of your medical training in a hospital setting.
Mm.
And so we spent a lot of time with patients and with specialists in hospitals from first year onwards.
Mm. And how long was the course, Penny?
It was 5 years.
I'm interviewing Dr. Penny Caldicott, who runs an integrative medical centre at a place called Gosford, which is about 1 hour north of Sydney, Australia. Now, Penny, how did you, when you graduated from medicine, how did you then train to become a general practitioner, or as they say in America, a family practitioner? What were training necessities?
Okay, so you do a minimum of 2 years within the hospital system, and 2 years was certainly enough for me at that end of the medical spectrum. When I first started my training, the specialist training for general practitioners or family physicians in Australia was relatively recent. So I did my specialist training part-time over a period of about 4 or 5 years, because within that time I also had 3 children in quick succession. That training is based within general practice, so you're actually being mentored by family physicians or general practitioners the whole time.
And did you enjoy that training, and did you see deficiencies in the Australian medical system at the time?
Look, starting from the hospital, I think, you know, I felt working in hospitals that there was really often a lack of understanding of the patient and where they're up to. I saw many patients being treated from an emotional perspective very inadequately. I found that quite disturbing, although I'm also aware of how busy time-pressed people are within hospitals. The case can also be made, and has been made many times in Australia, as we're short of general practitioners, that, you know, we don't have the necessary time to spend with our patients. I guess what I realised from the beginning is that the more time you spend with people on a single occasion or each time you see them, the less frequently you need to see them. So I started to see quite quickly that there are many conditions that are considered perhaps newish conditions that people didn't really believe in or understand, and that what we try and do in general practice is really fit people into a box of a diagnosis and then treat them within that, within the guidelines that have been set up by general practitioners.
A little bit like psychiatry.
Yeah, that's another story. We could talk about that for a long time. So I started to take care of patients that other people weren't interested in particular people who'd been diagnosed with chronic fatigue and fibromyalgia, and people with depression who didn't respond to, you know, know, the normal medications or in fact got worse on them. I was more interested in listening to people's stories and finding out where they'd come from, and had to, over time, do a lot of extra learning to develop the skills to look at disease states from their origin as opposed to just from the diagnosis.
Okay, so I want to get on to the practicalities of you setting up this clinic, the building that you found, how you set it up with the garden and the like. But also, now that you've brought it up, what sort of thinking was involved in working out what is going on with these people who general practitioners or family practitioners say, well, look, you don't really have anything wrong with you, so I'll see you in 6 months' time, sort of thing?
I think my feeling is that our training is quite inadequate, both from a perspective of medical student training and specialist training. I think that we become kind of problem solvers, but from, like I said, from the disease perspective. If someone doesn't fit into a diagnosis, then we either give them a label of a viral illness, of a emotional problem. We might tell them that they're too stressed, that they need a rest. You know, quite commonly I see people in their mid-50s and early 60s who are told that they're just getting old. So we have a lot of ways of kind of writing off people's symptoms when we can't put the picture together. It's very clear to me that we need to look at the body as a whole, and I think what medicine has done is separated not only different body systems, but even parts of body systems. So we're good at treating the symptoms. So what I mean by that, if I give you just a quick example, is we have so many people are on what we call proton pump inhibitors, which are medications that reduce acid production in the stomach, and people are on that because they've got reflux disease, you know, indigestion, tummy pain, those kind of symptoms. And we know that these symptoms are incredibly common in our society. The problem is that when you prevent the production of hydrochloric acid, what you're not looking at
in
is
the stomach.
In the stomach, which is how part of, you know, the process of digesting our food. How does that reduction in hydrochloric acid affect digestion and absorption of nutrients? And it's very clear that there are many there are nutrient absorption issues around using these particular medications, in particular low levels of vitamin B12. So that's interesting. So we're looking at a digestive system, and we look at one part of the digestive system without looking at what are the sequelae for the rest of that system. And we do that in many systems, actually. And then above and beyond that, we're not looking at, so if you affect one system, what happens to the next system? You know, and if you affect that system, what's going to happen to general health? And if you give, so another kind of quite common example is we use cholesterol medication called, they're commonly called statin medications. So what these medications do is that they do, in most cases, lower cholesterol. And an important part of the lipid profile called the low-density lipoprotein. The problem is that they also lower an enzyme, a very essential enzyme in the body called coenzyme Q10, which is what we call a mitochondrial enzyme. So the mitochondria are the powerhouses of the cells. It's where we make energy. So although we know that these statin drugs do lower coenzyme Q10, most doctors don't insist that their patients take this coenzyme Q10. And the consequence of that is that lots of people who are on statins feel tired, they often have muscle aches, they sometimes find that they have issues with short-term memory and concentration. And if you look at the patient information within some of these medications, it does say that the coenzyme Q10 is lowered, but we don't address it. So those are just very simple examples of how we're not really looking at the body as a whole, and how while we're trying to treat one thing, we may be causing harm.
Well, isn't that propagated to a degree by the drug companies in their propaganda, particularly in the US, where they advertise for any sort of medication, and very rarely do they give the side effects, and it's to get the patient to go to their doctor to ask for this medication without even understanding the pharmacology. Would you say that attitude of just treating a single system or a single problem within a single system, like indigestion in the stomach, is propagated by the drug companies?
I would agree with that, but look, there are two answers to that. The first is that as doctors, I think we have an obligation to understand the human body and how it works better. Mm. And so if we're going to prescribe these medications, we have an obligation to understand how they work and what could be the other implications for our patients. Mm. So that's the first thing. Secondly, you know, as we know, you know, many of the larger pharmaceutical companies are bigger than you know, many nation states in terms of their finances. And so, of course, they have a huge lobbying power. And I think, you know, we know that not all, but a substantial part of the larger research, you know, where they're able to involve many patients and therefore get statistically significant results, are done by pharmaceutical companies who have the money to pay for this kind of research. So we know that a lot of the guidelines that are set up are based on to a large degree, research that has been done by the companies who have a vested interest in us using these medications. So I think it's, you know, it's tricky. It's, yes, it's the pharmaceutical companies. Yes, it's the people who set up the guidelines and not informing themselves well enough. And yes, then it's also the doctors who give out these medications without really fully understanding the impact that they can have on the human body.
Yes, and the pharmaceutical companies tend to make drugs, or they invent new diseases like a social... What's the new term for shyness? And then they've got a drug for that.
Yeah, that's right. People who isolate themselves socially. I mean, that's... Well, you know, in medicine, it's a lot about labelling. So labelling's just really... describing a set of symptoms often rather than actual diagnosis. So irritable bowel syndrome. Mm. It just tells you that someone's got an irritable bowel. Now, there can be many
reasons for that. The symptoms of an irritable bowel, Dr. Caldicott?
Well, irritable bowel describes people who have bloated, who get bloated tummies, who get a lot of wind, who pass a lot of wind, who have who can be constipated or who can have diarrhea, and these can fluctuate, and often these people also have tummy pain. Sometimes these symptoms are associated with conditions that are stressful for the patient, and sometimes they're associated with specific foods which the patient is finding, their system is finding difficult to digest. But there are many different causes of these symptoms. But what we tend to give it a diagnosis of irritable bowel. So if we go in and the gastroenterologist does an endoscopy, like a gastroscopy and then a colonoscopy, and they find that everything's okay, many times these people are given the label of irritable bowel syndrome and basically told that they need to de-stress, that they might need an antidepressant, that they need to take more fibre. But they don't really look at the cause of this. And if these people have these quite marked symptoms, then there has to be a reason for them. Now, if the reason is an emotional one purely, which I find very unusual that it is purely that, then we need to be able to manage that. And if the cause is a physiological one, then we need to manage that as well.
And that's a different sort of investigation, not generally done by the average family practitioner.
Correct. So in our practice, most if not all of our patients get considerable relief of their symptoms, and many of them could lose the diagnosis of irritable bowel syndrome once we've treated them.
So I know this is a difficult question to ask, Dr. Caldicott, but how would you approach a patient who has been investigated by the gastroenterologist but still has their symptoms of, quotes, irritable bowel syndrome? How would you find out what is actually causing it, and how would you help them?
we have to understand actually what the body needs to have a good a digestive system that works well. You have to understand what the sequelae are of a digestive system that's not working well. We know that the digestive system is has roles. One is to absorb nutrients, digest food and absorb nutrients. One is like the digestive system is almost like our inner skin. So our skin on the outside is there to protect us, but there are also many functions of the skin that go beyond protection. And, you know, we do absorb some nutrients through our skin. We make vitamin D with the contact with sun on our skin. It has many roles, but it's there also to protect us from the environment. Our digestive system is the same, so that while we want to absorb certain nutrients, we also there are certain things that we digest that we don't want to absorb. So it really is there to protect us. And my experience is that when people have symptoms like I described for irritable bowel, that they often have poor absorption of nutrients, and you can test that by testing certain nutrients like ferritin, which is a circulating iron level, like vitamin B12, and looking at plasma zinc levels. So there are certain tests that you can do to see whether people are absorbing their nutrients well. There are signs in the body to look at too. You can look at fingernails, can give us certain signs about absorption of nutrients, and generally in specific zinc. The digestive system is also very important for the immune system. So the immunologists now say that 60 to 70%, if not more, of the immune system is modulated through the mucosa of the intestine. So that's where we've got some of our immunomodulating cells, specifically our Th1 and Th2 cells. And our immune system, as we know, is responsible for looking after infections, both viral, bacterial and fungal infections. And it's also really important for preventing us to develop things like autoimmune diseases, amongst many other things. So I'd be taking a history, a digestive history in terms of symptoms. I'd be looking at skin. Skin. I'd be looking at the immune system, and then the sequelae of not absorbing certain nutrients can also be seen through looking at the emotional as well. So looking at moods, anxiety, depression, looking at levels of fatigue, short-term memory. So I take a very general, really big history when I'm looking at the digestive system. I also look at medications, in particular hormonal medications, but also other medications that would prevent absorption of nutrients. And it's quite complicated, because then some low levels of nutrients will prevent you making enough hydrochloric acid, will prevent you from making good digestive enzymes. So it's a very kind of complicated mix. But as you can see, there are many systems involved in looking at the digestive system.
It's absolutely fascinating. I'm interviewing Dr. Penny Caldicott, who runs an integrative medical centre in Australia, in New South Wales. Let's go now into how did you set up your clinic, Penny? Where was it located? What were the specifications required for this clinic? And what sort of people do you employ to treat the patients?
Okay. So I had worked in general practice for about probably 11 or 12 years. I had been developing my medicine, but working in a very conventional, relatively conservative general practice environment. It might sound a bit funny, but I actually had a vision for this medical centre. So I was walking in the bush down on the south coast of New South Wales in Australia, and I had I thought it was just an idea, but it kind of came to me all as one picture of an integrative medical centre with an education component, and also with a therapeutic garden. And I thought, well, that's pretty interesting. And I thought about it for a while, and I was quite excited about it. And then I thought, this looks pretty hard. I think I'll give it a miss. So I had talked to a couple of people about it. About a year and a half after I had that first kind of initial flash of this medical centre, I had a very close friend of mine who I've worked with over the last 20 years come out from France, and a friend of mine said, "Oh, tell Rishar about this idea you had." And so I told him, and he told me that he and a group of therapists and doctors that I know quite well in France were doing exactly that, and I hadn't known about it. So it was at that point that I realised that really this was more than just an idea that I had, and that at some level I felt that it was something I needed to do. So eventually I worked with a fellow that helped set up the medical centre in Paris, and we established a team of people to work on this. It took us about 2 years to put together really our vision for the practice, what our mission would be, and to really develop our ideas around that, and to actually to find investors to buy and to build and modify a building that we eventually moved into. The integration is something, the idea of integration is something that's developed with time for me. Initially, what it meant for me is that we would be working in a team with general practitioners and with other therapists, so that we could, for each patient, set up a management plan that was unique for that individual patient, and to treat them together. Because I've never really been under the illusion, despite the fact that I've tried to learn many things myself, but I've never been under the illusion that I could do it all myself. And I've always found it really useful to work with other very skilled practitioners. We also went a little bit further than that, and we wanted that that everyone that was involved in the centre, even the non-medical people, that they really be part of building this vision, so that somehow we would create a relatively flat structure where everyone had their roles and their places, but also had an input into the vision. We saw that this medical centre would also be part of the community, and we hoped that it would link very closely with other medical services in the area that we live in, and that anyone who had significant contact with us would have a way of also contributing to this vision, which we saw as being an evolving vision.
So how long has this clinic now been operating, Penny? And tell us about the therapists involved and how it's all working.
Okay. So the clinic now has been open for nearly, it'll be 7 years in July. Can I finish one little bit about the integration?
Yes, please.
I think that what we've found since we've opened is that, you know, the integration takes place on many levels, and very importantly on the level of each practitioner with the patient is the really important thing, so that somehow we really find a way to communicate and be with our patients where we understand very, you know, at a very deep level what's happening for them, so that we can indeed kind of take a journey with them or walk next to them. Mm. I think that's the level of integration that we've found that's very important. So we started with, we've got 8 consulting rooms. We started with me working as a doctor. I had a number of patients who followed me, but we really opened the doors with faith that this practice would attract the patients and the people who needed to be there. Initially, we actually never really advertised for therapists. It's all been through word of mouth. People have heard about us and felt drawn to our practice. Mm. We started with a Chinese medicine specialist who'd been trained at a university in Sydney. And with a physiotherapist, a naturopath. Trying to think when the others started. I think that's how we started. We now have about 12 therapists. The majority of the therapists also are able to be paid by Medicare, which is our government-paid medical insurance. So we have now 3 osteopaths, a physiotherapist, a psychologist, an exercise physiologist, a dietitian, a nutritionist, a massage therapist, the Chinese medicine therapist. We have a mental health nurse. We have two nurses who work with the doctors. Trying to think if I've
Did you say osteopath?
Yeah, three osteopaths.
Masseur.
Massage therapist, a naturopath. Mm. Yes, and a kinesiologist who's just started working with us. So that, and at the moment we have three doctors. We do, we're involved in training of medical students. We're also involved in training of registrars who are doctors who are doing their general practice training. We've been involved peripherally with some research. We've got links with some universities. We run some programs of our area health service, which includes our hospital, are run through our education centre, which we call the SHED. We run programs for elderly people, for falls prevention. We've got Tai Chi classes and yoga classes, and we've got lots and lots of ideas that we yet haven't come into being.
Well, that's fascinating, Dr. Caldicott. Can you tell us how your patients, who just are just average people coming out of the community, are responding to this sort of not overwhelming care, but overarching care, if you will?
Okay. At the moment, we've unfortunately for a period of time have had to close our books.
What does that mean?
Which it means that we can't see any new patients. We have probably up to about 10 to 20 phone calls a day from people wanting to come and see us. As new patients, we have a relative wait to come and see us for normal appointments. We're really, really overwhelmingly kind of busy. We've found that there are a couple of different groups of patients. Because of our reputation for what we do, and probably more than that, our results, so it's pretty much word of mouth, we draw patients from a very wide geographical area, anywhere from about 4 hours north to about 6 hours south of our practice. We look after a whole range of people while we still do all the conventional general practice stuff. For most of our patients, we look deeper for the cause of their symptoms or the cause of their illness. And over time, the people that... So, you know, some people come in because of word of mouth and because they've tried everything and they really want an answer to their problems. Some people have come in because they live in our local community. And I would say almost without exception that when we explain to them, you know, our approach, that most people are very happy with that, that they really do want to get to the cause of their symptoms or their disease state. Most people, on the whole, we find aren't necessarily keen to have to take the same medication for the rest of their lives, or indeed would like to reduce their medication to a minimum. And so we work on that basis. When we talk about integration, we're not about saying that the conventional model is wrong. We're saying that the conventional model has some limitations and that we want to go past those limitations by using scientific understanding of a disease state to approach it differently.
And I suppose you haven't done any studies to see how your patients are faring, but off the top of your head, intuitively, how do you think the patients are responding both psychologically and physically to this kind of new medical approach?
Look, we can't say it's really completely new. I mean, there are many people, and certainly in the US, that are practicing integrative medicine and working within integrative centres. In terms of our patients, we're having a very good response, some really remarkable response in some areas, especially with the children that we treat. We treat a lot of children with ADHD, ADD, the new label of ODD, which they call oppositional defiant disorder, which I find a horrific label.
What does that mean?
It means children who are oppositional and defiant.
Naughty.
And angry and naughty children. And these kids can be pretty, that get the label, can be pretty terrible.
Mm.
But we find that it's really a biochemical issue behind production of neurotransmitters rather than that these are intrinsically, I don't believe in intrinsically naughty children.
No.
So I would have to say that 100% of the children that I've seen who would have been diagnosed with ODD are now doing very well. And, you know, there's no reason to give them those labels. Most of our the children that we treat with those conditions actually do extremely well, and it makes a huge difference for their families.
Mm.
One of the doctors that works in our practice, Dr. Nicole Avard, treats autism, and she's getting just outstanding results, especially for the children who get treated quite early, who've been formally diagnosed with autism or on the autistic spectrum. And some of those children have indeed become neurotypical, which means that they become normal kids. It's not it's one of the hardest things to treat. It's very complicated, but we're getting really great results. We're also doing extremely well with mental illness. We see a lot of people with depression, anxiety, bipolar, schizophrenia, the whole range of mental illness. And we're looking very specifically at the production of neurotransmitters in the brain and which biochemical processes may be at fault in the individual patient. And we're just getting really remarkable results. Our aim is not necessarily, especially in people with conditions like schizophrenia, to stop their medication, but to get them on the lowest dose of the least medication that we can to allow them to live with much fewer side effects, certainly, but with a vast reduction in their symptoms. So we find that many people with mental illness on medication are not necessarily symptom-free. It's very rare to find people who are symptom-free. So not only do we address the current symptoms that we have, but as we help their bodies to adjust the neurotransmitters, we can certainly reduce their doses of medication.
I'm interviewing Dr. Penny Caldicott, who runs an integrative medical clinic in Australia. Can you give just an example, Penny, of a patient in that category that has really improved remarkably and how that happened and what their diagnosis was initially?
Sure. This is a patient who I've talked about often. He doesn't mind. I've talked to him about it. He's a fellow of 37 years of age. He still lives at home with his parents. When he was a child, he was diagnosed in the autistic spectrum, they thought probably with Asperger's syndrome. When he became a teenager, his behaviour changed and he was diagnosed with schizophrenia. When I first met him, he was a very emaciated man. He was pale. He had no energy, had very poor concentration. He was having auditory hallucinations, which means that he was hearing voices, and he was really struggling with intense anxiety and periods of deep depression. He had very committed, very loving, very stable, gorgeous parents who were more than happy to take care of him, but also very concerned. He was emaciated because he'd over time developed intolerances to many foods, so that when he ate quite a lot of different categories of foods, that he would get really disturbing digestive symptoms such as pain and bloating and wind and diarrhea. And so over time they'd slowly eliminated foods that were causing him problems. And although his digestive symptoms were improved for not having these foods, he was also had become quite malnourished. So we, you know, I started with you know, of course, looking at the food issues, looking at his digestive issues, looking at his biochemical issues, and looking at which biochemistry he had that was preventing him to produce the right neurotransmitters. And after, I won't go into the details because that's very complicated. But after treating this man, for a period of some months, he became tolerant to many foods. Now there are very few foods that he finds that he has symptoms when he eats. So he's now a very well filled out, healthy looking fellow who has a capacity to do some exercise and stay fit. He was working in a kind of supermarket, and he's since done extremely well there and got awards, and he's very happy with what he's doing there. His auditory hallucinations have completely stopped. I have to tell you as well that he was on two different antipsychotic medications and an antidepressant and another mood stabiliser when we started. And the beauty of this treatment is that you don't have to change medication to adjust the underlying problems. So we just treat, and as necessary, the psychiatrist sees that the medications are no longer indicated, or in fact the side effects of the medications, especially the antipsychotics, can become worse when you don't need them as much. So things like fatigue and stuff. So the psychiatrist has taken him off one of his antipsychotics. He's reducing his antidepressant and also looking to reduce the second antipsychotic at the moment. The auditory hallucinations, so the voices, he's lovely because every time you see him, he tells you how many months, how many weeks, how many days, how many hours since he last heard the voices, because they used to drive him crazy. Mm. He's a very sweet man, and I think it was awful to hear these voices. So he's very chuffed about that. His parents, for the first time in their lives since he was born, have had holidays without him, and he's been able to be on his own at home and be quite happy with that. So he is a dramatically changed man. He's actually given me a lot of courage to continue what I'm doing, because when you're doing something that's quite different than what's being done in the mainstream, you certainly need to have some really good results to help you to continue, and especially to help you to motivate and help people commit to a treatment that that they actually have to pay for themselves. Because in Australia, the medications are heavily subsidised, but the kind of treatment that we use is not.
That's a fascinating story, Dr. Caldicott. How do you and your therapist get paid? What is the Australian system for medicine as opposed to the American system, which is mostly private insurance, number one? And number two, when your patients need a specialist, how do you arrange for them to see a gastroenterologist or a surgeon or a neurologist or the like?
Okay. Yes, it's a bit sad to talk about the Australian system compared to the American system, because in our system we're extremely well provided for. So Medicare, when you go and see any doctor in Australia, there's what we call a Medicare rebate. So there's a certain amount per consultation that Medicare will give back to the patient after they've paid their bill. On top of that, because the Medicare rebate in many cases, and especially in ours where we spend long periods with our patients, the Medicare rebate is often, you know, really not sustainable. So most doctors would charge a gap payment over and above that. But, I mean, really, in many cases, you're looking at $30 or $40 when you see, or less when you see a general practitioner. If we have
That's what the patient pays?
After they get their Medicare rebate.
And what does the government pay?
Well, the government pays the rest of that. So the majority
How
of the
much?
Consultation will be... It depends on the length
oh,
of the
right.
consultation. So if it's a under 20-minute consultation, I think it's $30-something dollars. So you can see that wouldn't be very sustainable for us. I think for over 20 minutes, it's about... $60-something, $50-$60, but you know it's a significant amount, so that the patients are not out of pocket. If we have patients who come in who are doing it really tough, You know, we can do something which is called bulk billing, which means that we take the government rebate only under circumstances in which our patients are really struggling. So there, you know, there is backup even if they're, you know, they can't afford the smaller out-of-pocket expense. If they want to see a specialist in Australia, they must see their general practitioner first. We treat them to the extent of our abilities. And, you know, any one general practitioner may have bigger abilities in some areas than others. So we refer only when we get to a point where we feel we can't go any further, and we refer them then to a specialist. Our specialists are very happy to be on the phone with us, and sometimes we even continue treating with their advice rather than them visiting the specialist.
That's wonderful. And then your area, general practitioners or family practitioners, I know you're involved with them. How do they perceive your integrated medical clinic and the style of medicine that you're practicing, Dr. Caldicott?
I can only answer that question on feedback I've had or what I've noticed. I mean, of course, you don't get all the feedback. The benefit for me, in particularly in this area, is I'd worked here for many years prior to setting up this clinic, so that I have the feeling and the feedback I get is that the specialist had already had a reasonable trust in me prior to doing that. So on the whole, the feedback that we've had has been pretty positive. I do have general practitioners who send me patients for specific things. I'm more than happy to look after parts and not fiddle with with their medication until the doctor, their GP feels it's necessary. And so I get referrals from GPs, I get referrals from psychiatrists who've noticed incredible differences in their patients and their need for medication. I occasionally get referrals from specialists, some of the hospital-based specialists, many referrals from nurses, from community health, from people who've seen the results of what we're doing in our clinic.
So you're really forging a new... Well, I know this sort of practice of medicine is going on in the United States, but in a certain sense you're a bit of a pioneer in the Australian medical system. Would you say that?
Look, there are other amazing integrative medical practitioners, that's sure. What we found... in the Australian environment and probably, look, in many other places in the world, is that these centres are not easy to get to sustainability.
Pay for themselves?
To pay for themselves because, the system that you set up in terms of doctors and therapists is a little bit different. The incomes are different. It's not an easy thing to do. Mm. So there have been many... integrative centres with great visions and stuff who have had to close. There are some that are still functioning in Australia. There are other good integrative medical practices. I guess the thing that we were really interested in is how do you set up a model for others? How do you set up a model that is accredited? So that means we have to get a government accreditation every 3 years. We wanted a model that really had a foot in both camps, so that we could be respected for the medicine that we do, and that we're adding extras that give good clinical outcomes, but without putting ourselves separately from the conventional medical system.
Mm.
And I think that certainly some clinics have tried to do that. Some clinics have set themselves as being very different. We've maintained some of the practices that other clinics have given up. So some people have been quite anti-immunisation. We still immunise. We still do all the things that the conventional medical practices do. And so I guess in that way we're a little bit different than some of the clinics. We've also, in setting up a reasonably flat structure, what we've really tried to do is create something that is truly integrative from the inside out, which is also a real journey to do that, we found.
So Dr. Caldicott, how do you feel about your life and your professional career, if you will, do you feel fulfilled and that you're on the right path personally?
Yeah, look, definitely by working in this environment that we've created, which we, you know, which was really important that it be a very nourishing environment. By working in this environment, I feel that certainly I can say for myself and probably for many of the other practitioners there, we've learned an enormous amount from each other.
Mm.
And we're in an environment that really encourages innovation, change, learning. And so our medicine and therapies are evolving all the time.
Mm.
And within our practice, we have clinical meetings with the doctors. We have clinical meetings with all the other therapists as well. We exchange ideas. If we get stuck, we're more than happy to ask each other. We don't have really big egos who think that they can do everything themselves. So it's been a really great learning centre. So I'd have to say that in the 7 years that I've worked there, I've learned just an absolutely enormous amount.
Mm.
I feel that my practice of medicine is evolving all the time.
Mm.
I feel that I'm able to look really at the cause of disease and in a really different way. I imagine that I'll never stop learning. So I at no point do I think that I've got all the answers. But at the moment, I certainly have, you know, a number of things that are working really well. But I'm, you know, we hope to kind of keep learning forever. How do I feel about it? I feel very happy with what I'm doing clinically. I love the ongoing learning. I love getting the patient feedback. Patients are really appreciative of the fact that no matter if the things we try are not working, that we'll stick with them until we find out what will work for them. And so in that we kind of set up that contract together, they're very patient if we try things that aren't quite right for them yet. And so we have this ongoing working relationship with our patients that is kind of collaborative as well with the patient. And I find that very rewarding.
Mm.
I think that, you know, we're in an incredibly privileged position as doctors and therapists that we share parts of people's lives that they may never have told anyone. We hear their stories and look at the whole picture in a way that not many people are privileged to do.
Well, like the priests used to once, huh?
Yeah, so we do. I personally learn lots from my patients through our interactions, through walking with them on their journey. And so our ongoing learning is both at a professional level and I think at a personal level. So I definitely feel very satisfied with what I'm doing, and really keen to integrate with other doctors and practitioners outside our centre to do teaching, to do more learning. We were part of setting up an integrative medicine conference, the first one they've had in the Philippines at the University of Philippines Medical School. That was at the beginning of last year, and that was a really wonderful thing. So we'd like to continue to do, we have a sister medical centre in the Philippines and the one I've discussed in Paris. So, you know, the integration inside and outside our practice is something that we have, really need to continue to build. And you did ask the question of whether we've really looked at outcomes. We haven't done any clinical trials. We did start by giving patients a standardised questionnaire of wellbeing. We collected lots of those in the beginning, but I think, and 6 months later, but I think what we're doing now has evolved so much from that point that we really need to look at that again and in a different way.
Yes, I think you should. Now, we've reached the end of our time. Would you tell us the name of your clinic and would you like to give out your website so people could investigate further what you're doing?
Sure. The name is Invitation to Health. Our website is www.invitationtohealth.com.au. Our website, I have to admit, is not wonderful, but it's something that we'll be working on. But it will give people an idea of what we do and who we are.
And can people communicate with you through your website?
Yes, they can. Through the website, you can send an email to a general email at the website, okay. And those emails can be distributed to the people it would concern.
Okay, thank you very much for an absolutely fascinating interview, Dr. Caldicott.
Thank you also.
You've been listening to Dr. Penny Caldicott, who is a family practitioner, a physician who runs an integrative medical healthcare clinic in New South Wales in Australia.
My mother was just a girl, 17. Oh, my mother was just a girl, 17. And my dad was passing through, doing things a man will do. And my mother was just a girl, 17. It's a wonder that I'm in this world at all. It's a wonder.
That was a track by Gillian Welch from her album called Soul Journey. Thank you for listening this week, and we look forward to talking with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.